Hello and welcome. This is Mark Weber. Those who have been listening to my talks in this series, or who have read writings by me over the years, or who are familiar with talks I've given at meetings, knows that again and again I've stressed the importance of understanding the United States' role in World War II. I emphasize the importance of the meaning and legacy of the American role in that great conflict, not merely because this aspect of history is very distorted in the United States, is routinely misrepresented, or because I want to make an academic point, but because the U.S. role in World War II has played and continues to play a profoundly important role in shaping the American narrative of ourselves, in the prevailing, accepted U.S. role of ourselves as a people. And therefore, it plays an important role in how we as Americans are supposed to think of ourselves as a society and as a people, and beyond that, in how we deal with the major social and political issues of our time. For example, the role of the United States today as a so-called leader in the world, with a vast military power, with dozens and dozens of military bases all over the world, with the proclaimed right and even the duty to prod and push other countries into conforming with the policies and interests of the United States, all of this is very much rooted in the American view of itself laid out and fortified in the U.S. role in World War II. This outlook, this view of America as the leader of the world, as the country that not only has the right or the duty to be this so-called leader in the world, is one that's accepted by the leaders of both major political parties and is backed up by Hollywood and the American media. But this view of America as the premier country, the one that has this right and duty to be the world leader, was laid out by the U.S. government and by President Franklin Roosevelt, with, of course, crucial backing by Hollywood and American mass media in the years just before and especially during World War II. And the World War II is looked upon and presented by American leaders, political and educational and so forth, as the good war, as the exemplary, moral, righteous conflict that the United States was involved in, so that whatever the United States did in defeating the Axis countries in World War II was right and proper and justified. And over again, American leaders refer to America's role in World War II as the Great War, as the justified and good war, and as a way of justifying and supporting what are considered parallel and comparable policies and role for the United States in the years ever since then. So that's why I'm returning to a sharp, close look at the U.S. role in World War II, with reference especially today to an important book by former President Herbert Hoover. Now, I've already talked a little about this book, but I want to return to it today because it's a very, very important look at the U.S. role in that conflict that deserves to be better understood. This book of more than 900 pages was not published until many years after the death of former President Herbert Hoover. The book and manuscript was held in storage for many years by the Hoover family, but it was only published just a few months ago. But it's an important secret history of World War II. It was written In the years right after World War II and up until 1963, and was worked on by former President Hoover, right up until just a few months before his death. It's been now edited and put together by the historian George Nash, and it sheds light on enormous errors of strategy and geopolitics that, in the view of former President Hoover, were of very, very profoundly dangerous consequences for the United States and for the world. Although President Hoover identifies many aspects of President Roosevelt's policies and of U.S. policy generally during World War II as harmful and dangerous and based on lies and deceit, the really important, the critically important part of this carefully written and well-researched book is the way in which Herbert Hoover details the folly, the duplicity, and the great harm of U.S. policy during World War II with respect especially to Germany and Europe. He persuasively debunks the popular entrenched view of America's role in the global clash as the so-called good war. Former President Hoover regarded this book as his most important, and it's very, very good thing that many years now after his death, finally, this book has appeared under the title Freedom Betrayed. Herbert Hoover has unique qualifications to present all of this because he was one of the best informed and most principled public figures of the 20th century. He was devoted to America as a bastion of liberty, and he supported a U.S. policy of non-intervention in foreign wars, one that was consistent with the outlook of America's founding fathers. And so his detailed analysis in showing how the record of President Roosevelt of deceit and lawlessness in promoting war in Europe and pushing the United States into war and in aligning the United States with Stalin's tyrannical regime is one that deserves much better attention and to be better known in our country today. I've already spoken a bit about the way in which President Hoover in Freedom Betrayed shows how President Roosevelt engaged in a secret campaign to provoke war in Europe prior to the outbreak of hostilities in September 1939. And I've also spoken about how Hoover shows that it was an enormous blunder for Britain to have given a blank check of support to Poland in early 1939, and which helped Poland to refuse to resist any negotiation, peaceful resolution of the conflict or the dispute over the city of Danzig. But more than that, as I have already laid out, President Hoover shows that America made an enormous mistake in making a military political alliance with Stalinist Soviet Russia in 1941, and then fortifying, strengthening that alliance in the years afterwards during World War II. One of the main points made by Herbert Hoover, and a point that many others have accepted, is that Franklin Roosevelt engaged in a systematic campaign of deceit, distortion, and fear-mongering, hysteria, in 1939, 1940, 1941, before the United States formally became involved in World War II, to prod and push the American public into supporting his efforts to bring the United States into the war. Above all, President Roosevelt, and backed up by Hollywood and the American media, told the American public over and over again that America had to become involved in World War II against Germany because Hitler and Germany posed a grave threat to the United States, and that Hitler and Germany were bent on world conquest, world domination, and thereby threatened the independence and freedom and liberty of the United States itself. But as Hoover makes clear in this book, Freedom Betrayed, and as I have emphasized on many occasions over the years, this, of course, is a lie, that President Roosevelt's claim that Hitler was intent on taking over the United States was completely without foundation. Now, this view is widely accepted by specialists and historians who really understand or have looked into all of this, but the contrast, the chasm, the difference between how between the historical record, the truth on the one hand, and of course what historians know to be true on the one hand, and the popular image on the other, is an immense one. Over and over, the American media, Hollywood, and so forth, continues to give the impression that Germany was bent on world conquest, world domination, and posed a threat to the United States, even though this is completely contrary to the actual historical record. Now, fortunately, more and more historians, more and more specialists are willing to acknowledge that. Maybe not so much in the United States, but certainly overseas. Just the other week, for example, there was a lengthy piece that appeared in the Irish Independent, a daily newspaper in Dublin, Ireland, written by an English-born Irish journalist named Kevin Myers. He's been a newspaper columnist since 1980, and a very prolific journalist who has also reported on wars in Northern Ireland, as well as in Beirut and Bosnia, and has also written from Japan, Africa, and from the continent of Europe. Well, in this article that appeared just recently in the Irish Independent, under the headline, "Everything People Believed About Hitler's Intentions Toward Britain Was a Myth Created by Churchill," Kevin Myers makes the point that the claim that Hitler threatened Britain, that he was intent on taking over Britain or Ireland or the rest of Europe, is, as he puts it, a great lie, a big lie. In fact, Hitler did not want to take over Britain. He actually admired the British Empire. And as Myers points out in his article, we know from the diaries of Lord Halifax, the British foreign minister, that Hitler offered peace terms that to Britain that did not involve any German control of Britain, but it was British Prime Minister Winston Churchill who refused to allow these terms to be even discussed by the British cabinet, and the details of the offers made to Britain and that Lord Halifax, the British foreign minister, knew about remain still secret in Britain today, remain secret for under 100-year silence rule. Instead, Myers writes, Churchill's determination to keep Britain at war turned what had been merely a continental defeat of the British army into an enduring myth that in 1940 Britain faced a war for national survival. As Myers points out, and as other historians, of course, have confirmed, this is untrue. That far from wanting to continue the war, in June 1940, after the defeat of France, Hitler ordered a 20% demobilization of the German army in order to restore Germany to a peacetime economy and to get the German economy moving again. In fact, now Myers doesn't go into great detail about this, but Hitler repeatedly made offers of peace, both in public and in private, through diplomatic channels, again and again, to try to prevent an overall war or to end the war once it had already begun. Most notably, he made serious efforts to bring about an end to the war in October 1939, after Poland had been defeated, after the end of the successful German campaign against Poland. And again, he made even more strenuous efforts to bring the war to an end peacefully after the defeat of France in the summer of 1940. It's important to remember over and over again that it was Britain and France that declared war against Germany in 1939 and not the other way around. In fact, when Britain declared war against Germany, because of the nature of the British Empire, London made sure that not only Britain, but also South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and India also declared war against Germany, even though, of course, none of those countries had any close or serious reason why they should be involved in war against Germany over a dispute involving the city of Danzig or so forth between Poland and Germany in 1939. Hitler's efforts to end the war peacefully, to bring the war to a conclusion in the summer of 1940, were backed up with peace proposals, as already mentioned by the journalist Kevin Myers in the summer of 1940, not only in diplomatic channels, but were also emphasized in a major address to the German Reichstag on July 19, 1940, a major speech appealing for peace that was broadcast in some 30 languages around the world. At the orders of Winston Churchill, this effort by Hitler to end the war was immediately and categorically rejected by Britain. And that's why, as Kevin Myers writes in the Irish Independent, just about everything that people believed about Hitler's intentions toward Britain in 1940 and still believe today was a myth created by Churchill, which he probably came to believe himself. Considering all the facts above, and considering how that myth has endured despite them, makes you wonder. That's how Myers ends the column. But as already mentioned, it's not just overseas, but even here in the United States. For those people who are really serious about history, who care about what the actual facts are, the reality of President Roosevelt's campaign of lies and deceit for war is widely acknowledged. Just recently, also, another piece put out by a conservative organization called the Future of Freedom Foundation and written by Tim Kelly emphasizes what he calls the noble lie of President Roosevelt's campaign for war. He notes that Roosevelt wanted to plunge the United States into the European war on the side of Great Britain, but was unsuccessful in provoking Germany in the North Atlantic. But as Tim Kelly points out, and as Herbert Hoover points out in his detailed book Freedom Betrayed, there is no evidence that Hitler ever entertained plans for world domination, or that he had any plans or desire to go to war, certainly against the United States. In fact, he had no real desire, had no interest in war at all with France or Britain or any other country, other than he had these ambitions, of course, to overthrow the imposed Treaty of Versailles. He was interested in reuniting all of the Germans and in securing a kind of German hegemony based on its population and its place in Europe, in Eastern Europe or in Central Europe, but certainly was no threat to the United States or Britain or France, far less so, in fact, than proved later to be the case of the Soviet Union. As Kelly points out, the standard history treats U.S. entry into World War II as a moral and strategic imperative. But that assessment, he goes on, does not bear careful scrutiny. Nazi Germany was not about to conquer the world, nor was she in any position to threaten the United States. One of the most important pieces of documentary evidence for Franklin Roosevelt's campaign to incite war in Europe are documents of Polish ambassadors and diplomats written in 1938 and 1939, which were captured by the Germans in Warsaw when they took control of the city in 1939. And the Germans published these secret Polish dispatches in early 1940. I've talked about these before, but I'm mentioning them again today because they're cited also by Herbert Hoover in his detailed book, Freedom Betrayed. Herbert Hoover writes specifically in his book, "Further American activities were disclosed after the Germans had invaded Poland in September 1939 and seized the Polish Foreign Office records. The Germans released a mass of documents which certainly indicated that the American ambassador to France, William C. Bullitt, who could act only on Mr. Roosevelt's authority, had made a profusion of oral assurances to officials of Poland and France, which they could only interpret as a promise of assistance of some kind of force from the United States. These statements by Bullitt were contained in numerous dispatches from Polish ambassadors abroad to the Polish Foreign Ministry in Warsaw. When published by the Germans, that is, in March 1940, these documents were denounced as fabrications by the U.S. government, by Ambassador Bullitt, and by Count Jerzy Potocki, the Polish ambassador in Washington, who is the author of several of these dispatches. But, as Hoover points out, subsequently the Polish ambassador, that is Potocki, informed me, that is Hoover, that the documents were genuine and that he had denied their authenticity publicly at the request of the State Department. In other words, this is just one more example of a blatant public lie by the United States government to cover up the duplicity and the lies and the warmongering of the Roosevelt administration. But as Hoover goes on, more convincing than these denials, then the files of the Polish embassy in Washington were given to the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and a new translation showed only minor differences between the documents that eventually were turned over to the Hoover Institution from the translations provided by the Germans in 1940. There were many of these documents, and Hoover quotes from several of the dispatches by the Polish ambassador Potocki. Above all, these documents record assurances given by Franklin Roosevelt's envoy in France, William Bullitt, that the Poles should not negotiate with Germany, that the United States would be supporting France and Poland in a war against Germany, that no matter how the war began, the United States would ultimately come on the side of Poland and of France in war against Germany. All of this, of course, was utterly, completely deceitful, illegal, and if American public had accepted or understood this at the time, should have or could have involved the impeachment, indictment of President Roosevelt as President of the United States. Well, we'll take a break at this point and return in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast. Hello and welcome back. In this second half of this broadcast, I'm going to continue to talk about the secret campaign, the illegal campaign by President Roosevelt to incite war in Europe in 1939 by pushing and prodding and cajoling Poland, France, and Britain into going to war against Germany, and specifically through President Roosevelt's efforts through the American diplomat William Bullitt, as shown and proven by the documents, by the dispatches by the Polish envoys to the Polish Foreign Ministry that record the efforts by the Roosevelt administration. One document, for example, dated January 16, 1939, by the Polish ambassador in Washington, Jerzy Potocki, speaks of how Roosevelt government was had abandoned all policy of compromise, that Britain and France should abandon all policy of compromise with Germany and not enter into any discussions with Germany that might be directed towards any peaceful territorial changes, and that the United States was abandoning its policy of isolation and ready in case of war to participate actively on the side of Great Britain and France, placing all its resources, financial and raw materials, at their disposal. 2 weeks later, as Hoover points out, the Polish ambassador in Paris, Lukasiewicz, reported to the Polish Foreign Office in Warsaw that, based on his conversations with Roosevelt's envoy William Bullitt, he writes, "In the case of war, the participation of the United States in this war on the side of France and Britain is foreseen in advance, of course, a certain time after its outbreak. As Ambassador Bullitt puts it, if war breaks out, we probably would not participate in it at the beginning, but we would finish it. For the, it seems certain," writes the Polish ambassador, "based on the talks with the American official Bullitt, that President Roosevelt's policy in the immediate future will tend to support France's resistance to stay the German-Italian pressure and to weaken Britain's tendencies toward a compromise over Poland." Even though Herbert Hoover quotes from some of the Polish documents in these that were made public by the Germans in 1940 to show the secretive campaign by Roosevelt to incite war, to push for war in Europe, Hoover is careful not to quote from many of these documents. He avoids quoting from some of the more remarkable documents in this series, which show not only that Roosevelt was carrying out this campaign secretly and illegally, but also that he was supported in all of this by a tremendous propaganda campaign by the American media that was also pushing, prodding the American public into supporting war against Germany. I mentioned, for example, that Hoover cites the dispatch by the Polish ambassador of January 16, 1939, but Hoover does not mention a dispatch written by the Polish ambassador Potocki 1 week earlier, written in Washington. And this document is very revealing. Potocki reports on the situation in the United States, and he says this, quote, "The feeling now prevailing in the United States is marked by a growing hatred of fascism and above all of Chancellor Hitler and everything connected with Nazism. Propaganda in the United States is mostly in the hands of the Jews, who control almost 100% radio, film, daily, and periodical press. Although this propaganda is extremely coarse, and presents Germany as black as possible. Above all, religious persecution and concentration camps are exploited. This propaganda is nevertheless extremely effective, since the American public is completely ignorant and knows nothing of the situation in Europe. Right now, most Americans regard Chancellor Hitler and Nazism as the greatest evil and greatest danger threatening the world. The situation here provides an excellent platform for public speakers of all kinds, for immigrants from Germany and Czechoslovakia, who don't spare any words to incite the public here with every kind of slander. He goes on to note that it's interesting to note that in this extremely well-planned campaign, which is conducted above all against National Socialism, Soviet Russia is almost completely excluded. If mentioned at all, it is only in a friendly manner, and things are presented in such a way as if Soviet Russia were working with the bloc of so-called democratic states. Besides this propaganda, the Polish ambassador reports from Washington, a war psychosis is being artificially created. The American people are told that peace in Europe is hanging only by a thread and that war is unavoidable. At the same time, the American people are unequivocally told that in case of a world war, America must also take an active part in order to defend the slogans of freedom and democracy in the world. In his book, Herbert Hoover tries to explain the motives of Franklin Roosevelt in pushing for war in 1939, and even more so, of course, pushing for the United States' involvement in war in 1940 and 41. And he explains it, the reasons he gives are very similar to those laid out by the Polish ambassador in Washington, who was reporting to Warsaw about conditions in the United States. Potocki writes that Roosevelt's motive in pushing for war was to serve a double purpose. In his dispatch of January 12, 1939, Potocki writes that Roosevelt first wanted to divert attention of the American people from domestic political problems, especially the problem of the struggle between capital and labor, and by creating a war psychosis and spreading rumors about danger threatening Europe, he wanted to get the American people to accept an enormous armament program which exceeds the defense requirements of the United States. In doing this, he needed to conjure up a war menace hanging over the world because of Chancellor Hitler. And, on the other hand, to create a specter by babbling about an attack of the totalitarian states against the United States. Hoover is very keen to make sure to leave out of his narrative any discussion, any detailed discussion, of the role of the media in creating a war psychosis in the United States and in supporting Franklin Roosevelt in the way that it did in pushing for war in Europe and for pushing for a United States role in the conflict. It's a little unclear to me why Hoover wanted to do this. He probably wished to make the book as and his presentation as acceptable as possible by leaving out any mention of the role of the Jewish community in the United States in pressing for war. But all the same, it's interesting to note the way in which he leaves that out. In his book, Hoover cites a passage from the diaries of James Forrestal, who was the first U.S. Secretary of Defense. And Forrestal writes in his diary, at the time he was Under Secretary of the Navy, he writes about a conversation he had with Joseph Kennedy, the father of John Kennedy, who had been the U.S. ambassador to London in 1939 and 1940, and therefore was one of the most critically placed, importantly placed, American officials overseas in the Roosevelt administration. Hoover quotes from the diary, saying, "I asked him," that is Kennedy, "about his conversations with Roosevelt and Neville Chamberlain from 1938 on. He," Kennedy, "said that Chamberlain's position," that is the position of the British Prime Minister in 1939, "was that England had nothing with which to fight and that she could not risk going to war with Hitler." Kennedy's view was that Hitler would have fought Russia without any later conflict with England if it had not been for Bullitt's urging on Roosevelt in the summer of 1939, that is, by the United States, that Germany must be face down about Poland. Neither the French nor the British would have made Poland a cause of war in September 1939 if it had not been for the constant needling from Washington. Bullitt, he said, kept telling Roosevelt that the Germans wouldn't fight, and Kennedy that they would, and that they would overrun Europe. In his telephone conversation with Roosevelt in the summer of 1939, the president, that is Kennedy's conversation with Roosevelt, president kept on telling him to put some iron up Chamberlain's backside. Kennedy's response always was that putting iron up his backside did no good unless the British had some iron with which to fight, and they did not. What Kennedy told me in his conversation jibes substantially with the remarks Clarence Dillon had made to me already, to the general effect that Roosevelt had asked him in some manner to communicate privately with the British to the end that Chamberlain should have greater firmness in his dealing with Germany. Dillon told me that Roosevelt's request he had talked with Lord Lothian in the same general sense as Kennedy reported Roosevelt having urged him to do with Chamberlain. What Hoover leaves out from this passage from the diary of James Forrestal about his conversation with Kennedy is interesting. As I already mentioned, he quotes Kennedy is saying that he warned Roosevelt that Germany would fight over Poland and would overrun Europe. And he quotes Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, as saying that America and the world Jews had forced England into the war. Now, this is a passage that Hoover leaves out of the diary, but that the Polish ambassadors in Washington and in other countries made clear that they understood that the Jewish community played an important role for its own interests, obviously, in helping to create a war psychosis and of supporting Roosevelt in his campaign to foment war in Europe in 1939. As I've already mentioned, Herbert Hoover's book, Freedom Betrayed, this book that he spent many years working on, is a devastating indictment of President Roosevelt's role in World War II, and more generally, of the United States' role in the war, and a debunking of the myth of the U.S. role in World War II as a good and righteous one. In fact, as Hoover lays out in great detail, U.S. role in World War II was a shameful one, underscored by the alliance of the United States with the Soviet Union and Stalinist tyranny, which was a betrayal of all of the principles and objectives that America claimed it was fighting for in that war. It can be concluded that Herbert Hoover regards, to a great extent, World War II as Roosevelt's war. And this is an assessment, this is a view that was held and concluded not only by Herbert Hoover, but by others. Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota prophetically predicted in April 1941, that is when Roosevelt was carrying out his campaign of calling for U.S. involvement in the war, but before the United States was officially involved, he prophetically predicted that one day the Second World War would be remembered as Roosevelt's war. He said, quote, "If we are ever involved in this war, it will be called by future historians by only one title, the President's War, because every step of his since his Chicago quarantine speech, that is in October 1937, has been toward war." The great American historian Harry Elmer Barnes believed that war could have been prevented in 1939 if it had not been for Roosevelt's pressure and meddling. Indeed, he writes, "There is fairly conclusive evidence that but for Mr. Roosevelt's pressure on Britain, France, and Poland, and his commitments to them before September 1939, especially to Britain, and the irresponsible antics of his agent provocateur, William Bullitt, there would probably have been no World War in 1939, or perhaps for many years thereafter. Barnes also writes, "President Roosevelt had a major responsibility, both direct and indirect, for the outbreak of war in Europe. He began to exert pressure on France to stand up to Hitler as early as the German reoccupation of the Rhineland in March 1936, months before he was making his strongly isolationist speeches in the campaign of 1936. This pressure on France and also England continued right down to the coming of war in September 1939. It gained volume and momentum after the quarantine speech by Roosevelt in October 1937. As the crisis approached between Munich and the outbreak of war, Roosevelt pressed the Poles to stand firm against any demands by Germany and urged the English and French to back up the Poles unflinchingly. There is grave doubt that England would have gone to war in September 1939 had it not been for Roosevelt's encouragement and his assurance that in the event of war, the United States would enter on the side of Britain just as soon as he could swing American public opinion around to support intervention. Roosevelt had abandoned all semblance of neutrality even before war broke out in 1939 and moved as speedily as was safe and feasible in the face of anti-interventionist American public opinion to involve this country in the European conflict." One of the most perceptive verdicts on Franklin Roosevelt's place in history came from the great Swedish explorer and author Sven Hedin. During the war, he wrote, "The question of the way it came to a new world war is not only to be explained because of the foundation laid by the peace treaties of 1919 or in the suppression of Germany and her allies after the First World War, or in the continuation of the ancient policies of Great Britain and France. The decisive push came from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. Roosevelt speaks of democracy and destroys it incessantly. He slanders as undemocratic and un-American those who admonish him in the name of peace and the preservation of the American way of life. He has made democracy into a caricature rather than a model. He talks about freedom of speech and silences those who don't hold his opinion. He talks about freedom of religion and makes an alliance with Bolshevism. He talks about freedom from want, but cannot provide 10 million of his own people with work, bread, or shelter. He talks about freedom from the fear of war while working for war, not only for his own people, but for the world, by inciting his country against the Axis powers when it might have united with them, and he thereby drove millions to their deaths. This war," Sven Hedin concludes, "will go down in history as the war of President Roosevelt." One of the most important lessons to be learned from all of this is the lack of principle of those people in America today, whether they call themselves liberal or conservative, when they uphold and support the notion of the U.S. role in World War II as righteous and good and moral. Because those people who support Franklin Roosevelt's campaign of deceit and of lawlessness in inciting war and in pushing the United States into war, thereby have no moral grounds for objecting when other American presidents carry out similar policies today. Liberals, for example, may be very unhappy, and Democrats may be unhappy, if George Bush lies to the American public about a supposed threat to the United States from Saddam Hussein to justify the U.S. bombing, invasion, and occupation of Iraq. And others may object to the current campaign by American leaders to create a war psychosis against Iran. But those people who say that America's role in World War II was a good and righteous one, and that Roosevelt's efforts were good, have very little moral standing in objecting when other American presidents carry out comparable, similar campaigns of deceit and lawlessness in provoking war in the name of freedom, democracy, and the American way of life. By the same token, conservatives have betrayed their principles in supporting the United States' role in World War II, because what Franklin Roosevelt did was a repudiation, a betrayal of America's traditional foreign policy of non-involvement, non-intervention in foreign wars and foreign disputes and squabbles. And this is a point made very, very strongly by Herbert Hoover in his book. Herbert Hoover was a staunch defender of the traditional American policy of staying out of foreign conflicts and of avoiding the arrogance of telling other countries how they ought to live their lives. Instead, Herbert Hoover, along in keeping with the spirit of George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and other American leaders, emphasized that for America to stay true to its own heritage and its own character must remain a bastion of freedom here in this country, which can only be done by staying out of foreign wars and foreign involvement. And therefore, it's important to remember that during his lifetime, real conservatives loathed Franklin Roosevelt and opposed America's policy, the policy of the Roosevelt administration in pressing for war or trying to get the American people to support war in Europe. But today's conservative, I mean, in the period 1940-1941, real conservatives supported, for example, the America First Committee, which was the most broadly based anti-war citizens campaign in American history. But real conservatives, consistent with traditional American policy, opposed Franklin Roosevelt's efforts. But today's so-called conservatives, with the notable exception of Ron Paul, support a U.S. role in the world as a kind of policeman, and thereby betray authentic conservative principles. That is, for those who call themselves either liberal or conservative, the support of the prevailing establishment view of the United States' role in World War II as a good, moral, and righteous one is a betrayal of the principles that both conservatives and liberals claim to support. And that's why the critique by Herbert Hoover of U.S. Of the Roosevelt administration's role in World War II is a very important one and deserves to be much better known. Well, thank you for joining me again for this broadcast. I hope you'll join me for future series of the Mark Weber Report.